ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 47, the Song of the Bee. We'll read texts 3 through 6 today, and we'll do the Sanskrit on text 3. Tang prashrayena vanatas susatkritam. Savrida hasekshana sundrita dibi. Rahasya prichchan upavishtamasane. Vigyaya sandesha haram ramapate. Tang prashrayena vanata susatkritam. Savrida hasekshana sundrita dibi. Rahasya prichchan upavishtamasane. Vigyaya sandesha haram ramapate. Tang prashrayena vanata susatkritam. Savrida hasekshana sunrita dibi. Rahasya prichchan upavishtamasane. Vigyaya sandesha haram ramapate. Ladies? Tam, him, Uddhava, prashrayena, with humility, avananta, bow down, the gopis, su, properly, satkritam, honored, savrida, with shyness, hasa, and smiling, ikshana, by their glances, Sunrita, pleasing words, adibi, and so forth. Rahasi, in a secluded place. Aprichchan, they inquired. Upavishtam, who was seated. Asane, on a cushion. Vigyaya, understanding him to be. Sandesha haram, the message carrier, Ramapate, of the master of the goddess of fortune. Translation and purports by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. bowing their heads in humility. The gopis duly honored Uddhava with their shy, smiling glances and pleasing words. They took him to a quiet place, seated him comfortably, and began to question him, for they recognized him to be a messenger from Krishna, the master of the goddess of fortune. Purport. The chaste gopis were enlivened to see that a messenger had come from Krishna. As Uddhava will discover during his stay in Vrindavan, the unique gopis could not think of anything but their beloved Krishna. Text 4. The gopis said, "We know that you are the personal servant of Krishna, the chief of the Yadus, and that you have come here on the order of your good master, who desires to give pleasure to his parents." 5. "We see nothing else we might consider worth remembering in these cow pastures of Raja. Indeed, the bonds of affection for one's family members are difficult to break, even for a sage." And text 6. "The friendship shown toward others, those who are not family members, is motivated by personal interest, and thus it is a pretense that lasts only until one's purpose is fulfilled. Such friendship is just like the interest men take in women or bees in flowers." Report. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains here that attractive women, like flowers, possess beauty, fragrance, tenderness, charm, and so on. And as bees drink only once of a flower's nectar and then leave it for another, fickle men abandon beautiful and devoted women to pursue other pleasures. This tendency is condemned here by the gopis, who gave their hearts completely to Sri Krishna. The gopis wanted only to exhibit their charms for Lord Krishna's pleasure, and in the pain of separation, they questioned the motives of his friendship with them. These are the transcendental pastimes of the Lord. Both Lord Krishna and the gopis are completely liberated souls engaged in spiritual loving affairs. By contrast, our so-called loving affairs being perverted reflections of the perfect loving relationships in the spiritual world, are polluted with lust, greed, pride, and so on. Like all liberated souls, the gopis, and certainly Lord Krishna himself, are eternally free of these lower qualities, and their intense loving affairs are motivated exclusively by unalloyed devotion. Om Gyana Timurandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chakshur Unmitamina Tasmai Shri Garbhena Maha Vanchakal Patrubhischa Kripasindu Devacha Patitanu Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. So we're entering into chapter 47 of the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is called the Song of the Bee. Sometimes Prabhupada translates it Song of the Bumblebee, so we hear it both ways, Song of the Bee or Song of the Bumblebee. And this is also called the Brahmara Gita. Brahmara, of course, referring to the bumblebees. And Gita means basically a song. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the 10th canto, there may be more, but there's at least 4 Gitas that are in the Srimad Bhagavatam. These Gitas are generally a set of verses that are poetic expressions, and particularly in the 10th canto, of the gopis' love for Krishna. So they're very beautiful compositions that really discuss the intimate relationships and the expressions of love of the gopis. There's the Venu Gita, first of all, where the gopis glorify Krishna's flute. Then there's the Gopi Gita, very famous, the songs of the gopis in separation when Krishna leaves them. When they're with Krishna, Krishna abandons the gopis and goes off into the forest. Then it's their song, their expressions of lamentation, of separation. So that's a very, very beautiful area. Then there's the Yugala Gita, where the gopis are singing of Krishna as he wanders in the forest. And here we have the Brahmara Gita, the song of the bumblebee, which is Radharani speaking to the bumblebee, almost in a state of madness, with some of the deepest expressions of spiritual love imaginable. And it's not, of course, specifically mentioned that this is Radharani. It just says one of the gopis in the Srimad Bhagavatam. But we understand from our acharyas, actually Srila Prabhupada, Vishnu Acharya Thakur, and even Lord Chaitanya himself mentions that this is Radharani's conversation with the bumblebee. The Brahmara Gita is referred to by Lord Chaitanya in a couple places in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the at the end of Yanchalila, and also in the Madhyalila 2360, Lord Chaitanya says, mad emotional talks include 10 divisions called Prajalpa and other names. An example of this is the 10 verses spoken by Srimati Radharani called the Song of the Bumblebee. So, you know, sometimes we use this word Prajalpa, meaning like nonsense talk. I don't know if that's real current. I mean, back when I began, that was a big word we threw around. Don't talk Prajalpa, Prabhu. I don't know if that's still current, you know, but that's the material sense of Prajalpa, meaning talking nonsense. Now, in the spiritual sense, Prajalpa, it means that one is so intoxicated with love, that one is in such a high ecstatic emotion, like Srimati Radharani, that one is almost speaking in a mad way or an insane way, or a way that, because obviously talking to a bumblebee would not be a normal thing that an ordinary person would do. But in Srimati Radharani's ecstasy, she's talking to the bumblebee, and we'll be reading about that later in this chapter. In today's verses, the gopis are beginning their discussions with Uddhava, and they sort of start off by saying, talking about Krishna's interest in them. First, they mention that, well, Krishna must be interested. He must have wanted to inquire about his parents, because obviously, why would he be interested in anything else? You know, we're just a bunch of coward people in this little village. Now, of course, he is this great king, you know, off in the big city, and would have no interest in us. There's one slight thing which wasn't mentioned here, but in text 3, it said they recognize him as the messenger from Krishna, the master, the goddess of fortune. Now, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur points out in his purport on this that there's a little bit of an irony there, for since they're calling him the husband of the goddess of fortune, in other words, he's off with, you know, Lakshmi, goddess of fortune, totally different rasa, of course, you know, of opulence and splendor. And in other words, they're saying, well, Krishna's off enjoying with the, you know, with the beautiful women of, you know, and his consorts of the city. And of course, we're just these simple coward people. He wouldn't have any interest, but he's probably interested in his parents, because this relationship with the parents is very, very deep. In fact, they make this exception. We're saying that people mostly act out of self-interest in the relationships. They say, except for the parental relationship. Now, it's interesting that the gopis mention this, because actually, this is one of the examples that Srila Prabhupada gives as a very special relationship between parent and child. And Prabhupada, of course, has indicated that even in this material world, the relationship between, he says specifically, the mother and the child is the closest relationship that we can understand, that's the closest to a spiritual relationship. And why? Because it's the most selfless. You know, because there's no self-interest between the parent and the child. Of course, it might be questioned whether it really goes both ways, at least until many years later when the children become older, and then they also then, of course, have to take care of the parents, and then the same sort of selfless relationship is reciprocated. Of course, I was just reading recently, now we have so many cases of elder abuse, so it doesn't always happen anymore in the material world that there's appreciation for the parents that raise them. In fact, I guess many people find this is now their opportunity to kind of get back at their parents for whatever they did to them now that they're old and infirm. But in an ideal world, there's this natural relationship of reciprocation of love between parent and child and the child and the parent. And so the gopis are saying this is somewhat of an exception. But they're saying ordinarily, relationships outside of the parental relationship are characterized by self-interest. And there's sort of the indirect, we could say perhaps criticism or chiding a little bit of Krishna, right? In other words, Krishna enjoyed with us, he was here, and now he's gone. It's kind of like, you know, now what? You know, he's just abandoned us after enjoying with us, and we gave everything to him, and now he's gone. So, of course, and it's carefully explained in the last paragraph of this purport, that we know that the relationships between Krishna and the gopis and Krishna Radharani are totally 100% on the spiritual platform. They're not subject to the failings of material relationship. They're totally devoid of this type of self-interest that the gopis are saying characterizes most relationships. They're saying just like the bee is only interested in the flower, gets the nectar, then goes off to another flower, never thinks about that flower again. Saying sometimes men will enjoy with a woman, don't think about her anymore, and they move on to find some other woman and simply kind of use them in this way. But of course, this is not the case with Krishna and the gopis. But because of the nature of the relationship, this is part of the sort of joking and reciprocation that goes on between them. And this is actually a display of very, very high ecstatic emotions. So we may not be able to understand this fully or enter into this, and we don't need to at this point, but we can hear it, we can understand it to some degree, and appreciate that this is a very wonderful, loving relationship that Krishna is showing between himself and the gopis. And part of their even chastising him slightly or being a little bit mad at him or kind of saying, well, here you are just using us and then going on, is all part of the ecstatic relationships that actually strengthens their love and deepens their love and makes it more and more flavorful. That's just so many different aspects of it. So often we see that Krishna and the gopis' relationships will mimic some of the aspects of material relationships, but is a quite different quality. While it may appear somewhat similar, like, well, here's some women that are jealous that, that the man that they loved is now not with them, it really is nothing like that. We have to understand from Srila Prabhupada and the Acharyas that the nature of the relationship is one of eternal spiritual love and has none of the inebrieties or the failings that we'll see in material relationships. So, back to material relationships, something that we're more familiar with and have a little more understanding of perhaps than these high spiritual relationships found in the 10th canto. We know that they are by nature imperfect. And of course the gopis are simply pointing out one of the imperfections, this idea that one tends to be very self-interested in relationships. Most people in this material world are convinced that there is a perfect relation for them, that they will find their soulmate, they will find their perfect love, they will find someone who will complete them. We hear all these expressions of love in the material world. And people have high hopes and expectations for finding the perfect person who is going to satisfy them, who is going to please them, and is really going to make their life meaningful, complete, and fulfilled. In other words, everyone is looking for the relationship to be Radha and Krishna. That's our material disease. We think that somehow or another, that in this material world, we will achieve this type of spiritual relationship that is only found in the spiritual world and only found between Krishna and his devotees and in spiritual relationships. But the illusion that we have in this material world is somehow or another that will be found. Now, of course, that lasts for some time, but generally, inevitably, there's disappointment. There's always disappointment in the relationship because no partner is going to be perfect, no husband, no wife, no lover is going to always be there, give us everything we want, is not going to make us feel ecstatic, every moment of the day, or even a lot of moments of the day, or even very many days, So this is what happens in the material world. In the beginning, we often see this romantic love period. And sometimes when you hear about the pastimes of Krishna and the gopis and, that sort of absorption and just thinking about Krishna day and night. And in other words, but remember, this goes on eternally for the gopis, right? The gopis are in this ecstatic mood of just loving Krishna, anticipating, when will I see Krishna? I'm just feeling desperate that I'm separated from Krishna. These emotions go on eternally. In the material world, we see a perverted reflection of that, this idea of people falling in love, right? Some of us have experienced this, or we've certainly seen this. People who fall in love. And what's the characteristics of that? They're completely absorbed in the other person. They're thinking about them day and night. They're meditating upon the pastimes they had with that person. You can see how it is a reflection of this natural spiritual quality relationships. But the problem is, many problems with it. The first problem is that it doesn't last, does it? Do people remain in that intoxicated state of being in love forever? No, it doesn't last. And in fact, as everything has been, this has been studied by psychologists, and psychologists have found that generally this stage lasts somewhere between 1 month and 1 year if it's at the absolute outside. So it goes on for a few months, and it's actually trace to levels of oxytocin in the brain. In other words, when there's a high accumulation of oxytocin, we have these feelings of love and ecstasy and euphoria and all of this, you know, and then those tend to subside over time, and thus those romantic feelings tend to also subside. Now, I don't want to be a complete, what's the word here? You know, I don't want to be a cynical, you know, whatever, and just, you know, because obviously there is real love. We have to remember that. But we mistake this for real love. This is often just a chemical reaction, or it has to do with our emotional needs being satisfied for the most part. I think I mentioned this before, but somehow the story of Romeo and Juliet is one that really resonates with me. It resonates with me as one of, it's because it's a classic love story, and it's a classic case of total illusion. It's one of our best examples of the illusion of romantic love, and it's, of course, one of the most famous. And people think, who are some great lovers from literature? Romeo and Juliet would be one of the first ones people would say. Very, very famous story. And, of course, William Shakespeare was a pretty good writer, and so he's able to draw people into it and, you know, get people really involved. And they have this, what's the term? Lakshmi, you probably know. Is it verisimilitude? That suspension of disbelief, I think it's a literary thing. That, in other words, something can be going on, it's completely ridiculous, couldn't possibly happen, but you willingly suspend that disbelief and become absorbed in the story. So that's what happens with something like Romeo and Juliet. Now, why is it illusion? First of all, it's extremely, remember, it's very, very brief. I think their relationship, they probably met about 3 times, and the whole story goes over a period of a couple months, and then they're dead. You know, in other words, they are killed off before the disillusionment period begins. You know, so they never had time. You can just imagine Romeo and Juliet 10 years later, and you know, it's like Romeo's thinking, "My gosh, this woman in the morning doesn't look like who I was looking up at the balcony, you know, in the moonlight, you know." And Juliet's thinking, "You know, this guy, you know, I thought was this great, you know, heroic person. And he just leaves his dirty clothes around, and you know, in other words, real life will happen eventually." And some of the romance is taken off. What's that? No. Anyway, okay. These characters are also very young. As I remember, I think they're like early teenagers. You know, they're adolescents. They have no experience of the world, you know, which, and by the way, adolescence is the period of greatest illusion even in the material world. You know, it's, people really are, well, they're just illusion, let's put it that way. Now, if we look at the relationship with Romeo and Juliet, we see it's a mental creation. It's an idealization. Did Romeo and Juliet know each other? Did they have some deep understanding of this person and their desires and who they were? And what? No. You know, it was they met a couple times, they gazed in each other's eyes, fell deeply in love. There's no knowledge base to this relationship. It's an idealization. There's no reality. And in fact, I would say the unrealistic nature of this is what adds to its enduring popularity. In other words, because basically most of us experience material relationships aren't very exciting. They aren't very interesting. And they don't really give that kind of satisfaction. So here we have this possibility. You know, this possibility that perhaps there could be a relationship which is perfect. And of course there is. But it's not to be found in this material world. So we can see this is a perverted reflection of that ideal that every living entity has within their heart of their relationship with Krishna, which they've forgotten. So we're looking for these perfect Radha-Krishna relationships, and we hope that they might actually be true. Of course, they are true, but not in this material world. It's an ideal that isn't possible in the material world. And this kind of material love is always going to be disappointing. It's disappointing because no one can fulfill the expectations that are put upon them. We can't expect another human being in the material world to provide all of the emotional, psychological satisfaction that we require. I don't usually like to read from non-scriptural sources very much, but this I thought was so well put, I wanted to read this. This is a qualitative research study by Naomi Quinn, professor of cultural anthropology of Duke University, called American Cultural Expectations of Marriage. It's kind of interesting because I think it really, really says it. Her summary was, interviewees mentioned fulfilling the needs in marriage or relationships for sex, love, companionship, shared experience, The need to be comfortable with someone and be important to someone, the need for trust, approval, moral support, help of various kinds, along with emotional security, cooperation, attaining common goals, closeness, attention, touching, feedback, understanding, feeling like being part of something, a need to be, to do for someone else, the need for personal growth, and so on and so on. Moreover, provision for the psychological fulfillment by each partner to the other is more than just contractual. It derives from a moral imperative from its place in the 20th century American concept of personhood. Being fulfilled has come to be regarded by Americans as something of a natural right. Since marriage or a like relationship is deemed to be the primary, if not the only, locus of such fulfillment, the kind that can be only met by another person, such a relationship itself becomes necessary for self-completion. And we wonder that people are not satisfied and fulfilled, and why we end up with practically a 50% divorce rate. Because nobody can fulfill these high expectations that people place on relationships now. It's simply not possible, even under the best of circumstances. Even materially, one cannot possibly be satisfied with all of these needs and expectations that are put on another fallible person, that this other person is supposed to fulfill all of these things. So then people naturally find, well, it must just be that this is the wrong person. And if I find another person, the right person, that will fulfill all of these things. And this goes on marriage after marriage, and it goes on lifetime after lifetime. People looking for satisfaction, looking for pleasure, looking for happiness by infallible people who can never really satisfy them. In other words, it's inappropriate and it's not even fair to the other person to have these type of expectations. So we need to look for spiritual fulfillment. Why do we look for it in material relationships? Because it's actually somewhat natural. It's not that we should condemn the people's desire for relationship. That's natural. That's part of the soul. That's the nature of the spirit soul, to seek relationship, to seek love, to engage in loving devotional service, as we know. That's the purpose of our life. That's what we are. That's our, you know, that's our sarup, you know, is being, you know, in loving relationships, of course, with Krishna. So these relationships that we find in the material world are simply reflections of the five original rasas that are there in the spiritual world. And Prabhupada explains this in many places, how these same relationships are being acted out in this material world in a way to try to satisfy the relationships of lovers, of parents and children, of friends, etc., and ones of service. So in devotional service, we are reestablishing our original relationship with Krishna. That is where we will find satisfaction. That's where we will be happy. If we repose our love in Krishna, we will not be disappointed. Our expectations will be met. They will be surpassed. Because Krishna is that only perfect person who can give us perfect love and perfect relationships. Now, in our beginning stages of Krishna consciousness, we will not, most likely, most of us, completely understand our relationship with Krishna. You know, we don't know our eternal relationship, our sarup with Krishna. And we may have glimpses and we may have experiences of knowing Krishna, relating to Krishna as a person, but generally speaking, it's not our constant state of being in constant loving relationship with Krishna. So what do we do? In the beginning of spiritual life, our relationship is really more with the devotees. Right? That's where most of our relationships are. They're with the devotees of Krishna. And to the degree that they are, our relationships with devotees are spiritual in essence, because Krishna is the center. So our devotee relationships are very, very important. Of course, our most important relationship is with the spiritual master. The spiritual master is the representative of Krishna who comes to this material world to teach us the science of Krishna consciousness and also engage us in loving devotional service. So when we relate to Srila Prabhupada as a spiritual master, it's not simply, well, here's a wise person who gives me some knowledge. You know, it's like, you know, in other words, well, we could just read his books, or we could read books, and it's much more than that. It's a relationship that develops. It's a relationship of love with the spiritual master. And that relationship is based upon service. And it's mutual service. We are serving the spiritual master, but how much more is the spiritual master serving us? By liberating us from this material condition of life, by showing us the highest spiritual understanding of love of God, of helping us to reestablish and reunite with our relationship with Krishna. Tremendous reciprocal relationship is going on there of loving service. So that's, of course, primary relationship. But we also relate to all the devotees. And when we say spiritual master, let's not forget also instructing spiritual masters, our shiksha gurus, as well as diksha gurus, all of those who give us help along the way in Krishna consciousness, those who help to bring us to Krishna consciousness, those who give us support, those who instruct us, you know, those that are offering so many things to us in Krishna consciousness. I think we all have senior devotees that we greatly respect, that perhaps we ask advice from, and these people are also acting as spiritual masters for us, as well as our Diksha Guru. And of course, our relationships are also with all the devotees, and this is, of course, a whole other topic, another class, but we know that, for instance, there's the four types of relationships that the Majjhima Adhikari devotee develops, and we relate to different types of devotees and different degrees of advancement of devotees in different ways. And there's so much, you know, information about spiritual etiquette, relationships. And we also see in our scriptures wonderful examples of devotee relationships. I think particularly we see this a lot in Chaitanya Lila, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and I'd say even more so even in the Chaitanya Bhagavat. You know, we see just example after example, these wonderful, loving relationships between the devotees. You know, it's like one devotee meets another devotee and they're like ecstatic and falling on the ground, rolling around. You know, it's like, there's real feeling, there's real love, there's real emotion here. And it's spiritual. These are like pure devotees, completely 100% dedicated to the service of Krishna, who are also dedicated to the service and love of one another, naturally, because the devotees are part and parcel of Krishna. They're Krishna's sons and daughters, naturally. We're going to love them as we love Krishna. So that's all there. We know the spiritual world is filled with relationship, it's filled with love, and there's ways that we can fulfill the real desires there. So these devotee relationships need to be spiritual, of course. We can relate with devotees in ways that are material. I mean, you know, it's certainly possible, and it certainly happens. You know, so what's the difference? Well, material relationships are material to the degree that they're influenced by karma, jnana, and things other than bhakti. So that means, typically, that really means our material desires, our needs for enjoyment. So if our relationship with another devotee is one based around mutual enjoyment, personal enjoyment, it's not so spiritual. It might have spiritual elements, you know, but there are also aspects of it that are material, that are not spiritual. And of course, until we are at the stage of pure devotional service, there will be these tinges of material enjoyment in our relationships. So it's not that we become despairing or we throw out these relationships or, you know, it's very, very neophyte. And we used to see this 35, 40 years ago. Those are older devotees. Remember this all the time. It's a very neophyte position. Well, this person isn't perfect, so therefore I give up a relationship as if I was perfect or something, you know, and I'm such wonderful association, you know, myself. No, this isn't the attitude. The attitude is that we work together to become Krishna conscious. It's a path. It's a journey of sadhana. I mean, there's sadhana bhakti to the point of perfection, little by little, step by step, and helping one another along the way. And of course, the aim, particularly of household life, grihastha life, we should say, is spiritual advancement. So, you know, will grihastha relations be 100% spiritual, no tinge of material? Probably not, let's be realistic. But the main purpose is spiritual. Krishna is the center, and that makes it go forward, that we are advancing step by step in Krishna consciousness. So how does Krishna become the center of our relationships? It's actually very simple. Through the process of service and sadhana. Just just like anything else, just like our relationship with Krishna develops through service and sadhana, through our spiritual practices and of course our service, our loving service. So if devotional service is the basis in a family, in a relationship between husband and wife, then there's going to be advancement. And there also, how to put this, there's always going to be difficulties. There's always going to be troubles. There's always going to be disappointments. There's always going to be expectations that aren't met. But the more the relationship is spiritualized, the more that Krishna is the center, and more that the common goal is there to work for Krishna conscious purposes, the more that we get through those disappointments and lack of expectations and difficulties that are there, they become less important. They become less of issues. So I firmly believe that within a family, within a relationship of husband and wife, there needs to be common purpose. There needs to be a sense of mission. Just like we all need a sense of mission in our own life, a temple needs a sense of mission and how we're helping to fulfill Srila Prabhupada's desires and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission to bring Krishna consciousness to the whole world. We need to think that way within our families too, within our relationships. What is that common mission that we have to help Srila Prabhupada, to assist Srila Prabhupada or our guru, to spread Krishna consciousness? Now, we may not be able to do it full time or even to a large degree of time. You know, many people in household life are very involved with, our duties, making a living, supporting a family, and that's all devotional service as well. But if we focus exclusively on that duty, then we may miss some of our sanatan dharma, our more highest duty of developing Krishna consciousness. So as well as service, sadhana must be there. And the sadhana also helps keep us on the right track. If one is performing devotional service, chanting one's rounds, following the principles, and particularly, and within household life it can be difficult, but if we can somehow or another keep some focus on hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam, chanting the holy name, worshiping the deity, associating with devotees, and of course our fifth principle, residing in a holy place, which we are all doing here in the Ramanreti, in this holy dham, then we will make spiritual advancement. And through that devotional practice, through our sadhana that we share together, and through a common purpose and mission of helping to spread Krishna consciousness, our grihastha life or our brahmachari life or sangha, any ashram that we are in, will be successful. It's no real different. The keys to Krishna consciousness, to advancement, are the same regardless of one's position or ashram or gender or whatever. Spiritual practice is one, but how it actually manifests itself may be a little bit different according to our circumstance. But again, if Krishna can be the center of that relationship somehow or another, then that relationship can be freed from so many of the material difficulties, these problems and frustrations and disappointments that we so often see in the material world. And more, as it becomes spiritualized, we make advancement in Krishna consciousness. And as we do, we can more and more appreciate these very, very deep and wonderful pastimes that we're reading about in the Srimad Bhagavatam, because they give us the example of the perfection, the highest stage of relationship. Not that we are going to have a relationship like Krishna and Radharani, but we certainly can understand the relationship of great devotees and how they're appreciating these pastimes and the relationships of Krishna and Radharani. Sorry, one more thing, but I am out of time, as I see. Okay, I think we'll end at that point. Do we have comments or questions? Father Lakshmi Modi.
When you were reading that excerpt from the psychologist or whoever she is, I was thinking, you kind of addressed it towards the end, but I was thinking that people approach ISKCON, or the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, which, by the way, sometimes we think of as a person, like ISKCON does this or that, or yeah. I don't know who that person is, but we go to ISKCON with that same list. And then we do the same thing when we find that that list is not met to our satisfaction. We try to find another organization that we could pin that list on. And because the mentality is the same, looking for that material perfection of satisfying all our needs, then we're disappointed, because really the International Society for Krishna Consciousness and our relationship with each other and the devotee and Srila Prabhupada is a vehicle for serving Krishna and developing that relationship with Krishna. But it seems to me that it's about how we, the consciousness with which we enter into whatever relationship, even if it is a potentially spiritual relationship, if we enter into it with the wrong mentality, then it does the same thing.
That's a great point. I wish we had, 10 or 20 minutes to discuss that, because that is so important. It's something I run into, a lot of us run into all the time. Yeah, the same sort of disappointment, which manifests in why don't they do this? Like you say, ISKCON is like a person. It's a why, or why, it's like, why don't the leaders, why don't they, why doesn't this happen? Why? And, and people, they have their own frustrations. I spoke not too recently, but a year or two ago, I was speaking with someone, a devotee, who was very, very bitter, who was talking about something, how he was mistreated. And he was mistreated in 1984, which is now 30 years ago. And you just kind of almost want to say, whatever happened, I'm sorry, but get over it. Move on. You're stuck 30 years ago in something that somebody did, some immature devotee or somebody or whatever. Who knows what the circumstances were? He may have even been in the room, for all we know. But it's like, exactly. Our attitude needs to always be, what can I do for Krishna? What can I do for Prabhupada? What can I do for my guru? Sometimes things aren't always fair. Sometimes people are disappointing. Sometimes devotees are disappointing. But it doesn't really matter, ultimately. What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do? How am I going to fulfill my purposes and my mission? And how am I going to assist Srila Prabhupada in his mission? That's what's really important. We don't want things to go on which are not appropriate. We obviously want to take care of devotees, but sometimes things are going to slip through the cracks. There's going to be mistakes and things are going to happen. So we need to learn how to accept what we can't change as coming from Krishna somehow or another. What is the lesson from Krishna? And maybe part of that lesson is, I shouldn't do this to anybody else. What happened to me? Maybe I need to become a better person, from that experience or from that example. And there's going to be so many different lessons that are there. But the point is, yes, we don't, if we're expecting everyone else, even we can say, they're devotees. You say, are devotees going to act perfectly? The easiest way to answer that is, do I always act perfectly to everyone else? No. Maybe when I do, I might be able to expect them from others, but if I was perfect, then I wouldn't. I would just be merciful to everybody. Anyway, you get the point. Okay, we're real short on time. Is there another question or two? Okay, Keshava Prabhu.
You were saying how Krishna is a perfect person. Sometimes I run into common people who question that you said Krishna is a perfect person, but he's stealing butter and he's at night with young girls and so on and so forth.
People actually say that.
How would you
really? You run into that? it's like Prabhupada, I know it's mentioned that, like people will criticize. I'm like, who's going to criticize? But they do. I run into that too. Every once in a while, it's usually people of the from India, I guess we could say, because Americans don't even know anything. They don't even know any pastimes to criticize Krishna. It just has to be explained that these are totally transcendental spiritual pastimes. And because it's so difficult to understand the difference between spirit and matter, what is spiritual and what is material, isn't that the crux of self-realization? understanding that. And since people do not understand that and are very confused about this, it's very difficult for them to get out of a material thinking, to get out of those paradigms and see that this is something very different. Prabhupada gives example of, you know, the sand and the sweet rice. You've tasted, you know, some sand is in sweet rice. We never have that here, do we? You know, but I actually did taste some sweet rice. Had something like that at once. It's pretty horrible, you know. So it could make you think, well, sweet rice is terrible, you know. Like, I don't ever want that again. Well, no, of course. But that doesn't mean that there isn't good sweet rice. You know, I have to just say that when I first became a devotee, you know, most people say they come a lot of times because of prasadam and how good the prasadam was and how that brought them. For some reason, the temple I joined in 1972 had probably the worst prasadam ever on the face of this planet. It was horrible, and it was tended to be usually left over, and they had no refrigeration, and then to be stale the next day. And, you know, then they would try to heat up the stale dal, and they didn't have the proper utensils, and they would burn the dal, so it was stale and burned. You know, so I thought the first several months of Krishna consciousness that prasadam is one of those austerities, like getting up early, taking a cold shower, having to eat this prasadam. I just thought, well, you got to just do it. Then I went somewhere else, and a whole new world opened up for me of prasadam, and never looked back. But at any rate, yes, that's the situation. So you know, people don't understand how the spiritual world is different because they don't have that experience. So how do they get that experience? From hearing. You know, you simply have to hear this philosophy. You hear about Krishna. You hear the pastime. You know, devotee, we just have to explain to them how the spiritual world is different than the material world. And actually, if you notice that some people who aren't too tainted, who don't know too much, they're often people are so relieved to hear this, aren't they? I think people, you know, are so relieved to know that, yes, you know, it's not just me. I always thought everything, you know, was wrong. I was just some bummer, you know, or that it just nothing was right. You know, so people are often greatly relieved. Yes, this material world is not right. Things shouldn't be this way, and there is a place that's different. There is a spiritual world. There's a spiritual reality, which is completely in contrast to this material, disappointing, you know, place of suffering. Anyway, it just takes a lot of explanation. They'll get it if they're sincere. If they want to hold on to something, oh, Krishna's this, Krishna's that, what can you do? You know, Mother Sukha. And I think we have to stop at this point.
I know you probably didn't mean it this way, but I just felt compelled to address it, this idea of moving on. You know, it's been such and such amount of time, and it's time to move on. But unfortunately, for some people, you know, I've witnessed it, the experience that they had was so bad, and they felt so no support, you know, that they can't move on. It really takes somebody or more than one person to sit down and listen to the situation and really empathize, because, I mean, karma's always there. Maybe in your past life you did this or you did that. But people get really seriously wounded sometimes from, let's say they were kicked out of a temple, or let's say something happened to their child. So it's kind of like, I always think when I was in Calcutta once, and Srila Prabhupada was giving a class, and he mentioned, you know, three things that Chanaka Pandit had said, one of them being, you see everyone's property, you see everything as...
Something in the street or
garbage
in the street,
right,
or something,
right,
else.
Right, yeah. Right, right, right. And you see everyone else's problems as your own, you know. So I think that, you know, with people like you're speaking of, you know, unless it's been gone over ad infinitum and what can be done, sometimes it just takes real empathy. And also, I know one thing that's been useful for myself when tragedy has struck or whatever, I just think, well, what if Krishna made this? What if this was my last birth in the material world? And Krishna's giving this to me just so that I can, you know what I mean? So that I can go back home. Would I change anything that's happened? When you kind of look at it that way, you think, well, you know, maybe not. I just, again, I don't think you necessarily meant it that way, but for some people,
let me address that. I think it's a very, very good point, and I absolutely agree with you. What you described at the end, of course, is a very very advanced way of looking at it, you know, seeing how this may be coming from Krishna and my last birth and all of that. I certainly didn't mean to minimize experiences that people have and minimize that we need to have a lot of empathy and we need to give help to devotees when they're having difficulties. Prabhupada said when a devotee leaves, he said 50% their fault, 50% ours. So in other words, we do need to take that responsibility of what kind of experience, what kind of association have we given that person? Have we helped them? Did we do everything we could to help them in Krishna consciousness, you know, and to be able to have that kind of experience and relationship needed? Of course, I was dealt with for many, many years being on the Child Protection Office, some of these real issues, and I saw that many of our young people had very, very bad experiences, and they have bad experiences within ISKCON at the hands of devotees. So I would never tell them, just move on, you know, get over it, it's your karma. Those type of things are extremely unhelpful, do very little good, and aren't even really completely true. You know, it's half the truth, it's half the story. And people require time sometimes to heal, to get over things. And just being there with people, listening to people, helping devotees is sometimes the best thing we can do. One quick story I'll end with. I met one devotee. This was way back, it was maybe 8 or 10 years ago when I first started working with the Child Protection Office, and it was at one of the those Kuli Mela or whatever they are, those reunions they used to have in Los Angeles. And I was talking to one young man who was a second generation, and he had gone through abuse in the Gurukula. But he seemed to have a really good attitude, and he was kind of like back into things and feeling okay. And he was very philosophical, and he had, you know, some good insights. I said, well, how did you reach this point? And he told me, he said, well, I was very, very bitter. He said, and I was probably very unfair to devotees, and I was probably obnoxious to be around. And, you know, he said, but some senior devotees just stuck with me. And they just listened to me, and they just helped me, and they just kind of like stayed my friend even when I was, you know, like, going all over the place, he said, and through that, you know, that just helped me. That helped restore my faith until eventually I come to the point of understanding and getting a better spiritual perspective on what happened to me and how I can now deal with this and go on and move on with my life. So yeah, devotees can be very instrumental in helping one another when we do have difficulties. And I think it's a combination of we preach to people, we give philosophy, but it has to be done with love. It has to be done through a relationship. And we all know that. If somebody is like your best friend, and they really care about you, and you know they care about you, and they say, Mother Sukada, have you ever thought about it this way? And they may say something that, you know, you might not even agree, but you'll listen. You'll take it under consideration. You can hear it. You can hear when there's relationship. Why did we hear from Srila Prabhupada? Because we knew that Srila Prabhupada loved us, he would never cheat us, that, you know, in other words, there was, you know, perfect relationship. We could completely trust what Srila Prabhupada told us. So if there's relationship, if there's love, if there's trust, then we have positioned the opportunity to help others. I hope that helped clarify that. It's going to be really quick. Go ahead. We're way over time, and I
had a similar point to Sukhita, but Mataji, one thought that occurs to me, though, is that our movement has changed pretty dramatically. You know, like going back into the 70s and 80s, it was pretty rough, the dealings. And now that I see many, many devotees are making conscious efforts to be sensitive and loving and see that as coming from Krishna, that prompting. So anyway, that was...
Well, I think it's a good point. I really agree with that. Yeah. Okay. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.